We've got two outlaw men, or former outlaw men, here with us tonight. Frank Collada, Andrew DiDonato, and their biographer, Denny Griffin, opening up the phone lines with your questions for these very interesting guests coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. If you are a student of the mafia or just interested in little slice of American life, these books that we're talking about by our guest tonight are pretty good stuff. I recommend them. Battle for Las Vegas is one written by Denny Griffin, Surviving the Mob by Denny and Andrew DiDonato, and Collada by Frank Collada and Denny Griffin give you a good insight into how this whole thing works. We're going to the phone lines now. Actually, wait a second. I want to ask one more question. Frank, this is for you.
Yeah.
There's an unsolved crime. I guess it was solved in a way, but I've always wondered about it. It's, and I don't know if you know or not, but it's a newspaper reporter named Don Bowles who was killed in a car bombing in Phoenix. I didn't know if you ever heard anything about that or not.
No, I hadn't, George. No, I didn't hear anything about that. I know the guys that, if they would have done it, they would have been these guys that were connected to Chicago and lived out there, but I don't know for sure, and I couldn't just say it, you know.
Oh, okay. East of the Rockies, George in Manhattan. Good morning, George.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Listen, this is absolutely incredible that I've listened to every second of this show tonight. The one thing that your guest said that you're talking to now was when he gambled, he always gambled with his own money. Ho, ho, ho! You talk about politicians, they gamble with our money, which is insane. But mobs have been around since the beginning of time. In fact, the Tea Party in Boston that led to the founding of our country, that was a mob. And what it is families trying to survive. And that's it. There's a big difference between a pack of wolves, a lone wolf, and a wolf in sheep's clothing. And I would beware of the wolf in sheep's clothing. Forget about the families that struggle and try to get ahead. And okay, so you cross the line and you break a few commandments, which is not a good idea. But it's very understandable. It's been going on since the beginning of time.
Well, it certainly has been going on since the beginning of time in your neck of the woods there, Manhattan. George, did you have a question for our guest?
A question. Thanks for writing the book and trying to do your best to straighten your life out. That's the most important thing. You know, life is short. Eternity is long. And, you know, we got a big judge to answer to at the end.
Well, let me put it this way, Frank, and then to you, Andrew. You guys have paid a price. It's not like you got off scot-free. You testified against your former colleagues. You both did time. You lived in a witness protection program and had to worry, and probably still do, about somebody tapping you on the shoulder or blowing you away. You would agree that you have paid a price?
Yeah, of course.
I've
did time in a penitentiary for it, and constantly for many, many years lived under the thought of being hit in the head at any given time. And not that they're all in jail. Of course, I don't feel that way anymore. They're all dead and in jail. So, you know, I don't have that feeling anymore, but sure, we paid the price.
Same to you, Andrew.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I did a lengthy time in prison, you know, testifying, going to the witness program, turning my whole life upside down, you know, doing these things to protect my family and going through that, and, you know, the strain and the struggle that it put them through as well. So, you know, I paid a dear price. You know why? Me and Frank still pay today. Every day we pay, because there's things that we lost in our lives that we can never get back. And this is the price to pay to get freedom and to get ourselves new lives. And, you know, a part of having a new life was to pay that price. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you just can't go back. And that's what it is. You know, there's certain things that we will never get a chance to do. But then again, this is the price you pay, you know. And like Frank says, any day you never know if somebody's going to come up behind you or something like that, you know. But you just got to keep on marching forward and trying to, you know, do things positively and turn out a positive message somehow, and maybe somebody can understand, or you could help somebody along the way.
West of the Rockies, someone who says their name is Mafia Princess in California. Good morning, Princess. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Hi. I wanted to ask your
guest
there, Frank, if he knew what a Mafia Princess was.
Well, that's what they used to refer to Sam Giancana's daughter as a mafia prince. You know, she was his daughter, and she was treated like a little princess, you know. So that's the way we looked at it. You know, that's what a mafia
right. Is. Well, that's basically what anyone who's any daughter of one of the men that were in the mafia at that time in Chicago was called. Was a princess.
Right. That's the way we took care of our kids, you know.
Especially so Miss Princess, who's your dad?
I'm sorry?
Who's your father?
I'd rather not say his name, but I'll tell you he worked for, he was Sam Giancana's bodyguard. And he was also, this is way, way back, more in the 50s and 60s.
That's,
my father was extremely well known in Chicago.
It was rolling heavy in that, hot and heavy in the 60s, 50s and 60s.
The whole city was owned by the mafia at that time.
That's right.
There wasn't anything that they couldn't get into. My father was also, he not only was Sam's bodyguard, they put him in a police position. And he actually was an officer in Chicago.
Frank, did you have guys in the police department?
Oh, yeah, certainly. That's where we used to get a lot of our information from, throughout the police department. Absolutely. And as she said, you know, are you still there? Because my phone seems like it's dead.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah, we had a guy that was in charge of the, what do they call it, criminal, CIU, they call it.
Intelligence?
Intelligence unit, yeah. He was connected to the outfit, so certainly we had people in police positions. I'm just trying to figure out if I knew her old man.
You don't want to say his name, huh?
I'd rather not.
Oh, come on.
I'd rather not. He was known as Big Tommy. He was a three-wheeler. I don't know. It depends on how old you are, you know, because he died in 72.
Oh, yeah.
It was probably before your time.
No, I was connected then. I was in the penitentiary then.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't before my time. I was already in there for 5 years.
Uh-huh.
All right, Miss Princess, last name unknown. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Andrew, did you have did you guys have cops on the payroll?
Well, there was definitely intelligence, like Frank said, throughout some law enforcement people in the New York area. There were certain crime families that had direct links to intelligence guys and certain cops. I mean, there was a case that just went off a few years ago with the Lucchese family. With Anthony Gaspipe Castro and the two cops from Las Vegas. They had moved to Las Vegas after being cops for so long in New York, and they got convicted of multiple homicides, actually murdering guys for the crime boss.
Oh, yeah?
So it does, it runs deep sometimes, and other times it's just intelligence or guys who are, looking for money. Like we said before, George, whenever there's money involved, there's going to be some sort of corruption along the way. You can't, it's not everybody, but it does happen.
First-time caller, Peter in Middleton, Connecticut. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good.
I have a question for Frank. I was wondering when you first met Henry Hill. He's a friend of mine, and Lisa's, and they're here in town for a funeral.
Right, I know.
So I just was wondering when Frank first met Henry.
I met him about 2 years ago at an event, a speaking engagement for people, And that's about 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, not no further than that.
Yeah, Peter, Peter, tell Henry we're sorry he couldn't be on the show. I was looking forward to that.
Yeah, I heard it from your screener. She informed me of that tonight. I didn't realize that he was supposed to be on tonight.
Yeah, he was supposed to be on the first hour and called us earlier this evening to say it couldn't be possible. Denny Griffin, I want to bring you back in for a second. Maybe you can address this sort of issue. You have sort of a stable of these guys, Andrew and Frank and Henry Hill, who you help organize events and book signings and things of that sort, right?
Yes, absolutely. Got I run a small company called Bear Media Consultants, and people who are looking for speakers, TV producers, documentary producers who are looking for technical consultants or people to be in their documentaries and so forth. If they contact me, then I have several people that I am able to contact to try to find them the person that they're looking for.
Did you produce something recently with Andrew, a DVD?
I wasn't involved in the DVD. Andrew produced a DVD not too long ago. Well, I guess it's been a couple of years now.
What's the story on that, Andrew?
No, it was just a DVD I did. It was more of like a cautionary thing, like trying to be like one-on-one with like, you know, young people, something like that. Let them see what I went through. I did it with a very small company, and we just put it out there for a short period of time, and it did really well, and you know, it got the message across, and then the book came out, and then once the book came out, I put 100% into that, and. But Dennis and Dennis's company has helped me, and Frank, and other guys that we know across the United States. It's helped us along the way, doing speaking events and stuff like that. It's been very interesting, and, you know, a lot of people got interested in it, and as long as we can go out there and do something positive, I'm with it. So,
can you make a living at this stuff? Frank, I know your book's been out for a while now, but you had other business interests. I don't know if you still own your joint or not.
Well, no, I just retired from my last business. But my book, you ain't going to make a lot of money off books, I can tell you that now. But my book has come back. You know, it's been out there 5 years. And when it first went out there, we were at number one on the list. And then the distributor went bankrupt. So I lose like, you know, a lot of money, all right? Because what are you going to do? So it's going to cost you $50,000 to sue them. So I lost a lot of money when my book first came out. But it's starting to come back strong again. Now it's really getting strong. I sign a lot of books. When they say I'm coming to sign books, people do line up early, and it's an honor to be able to sign these books and talk to these people. I'm very humble when I'm around people.
Well, I hope both you guys get some, all three of you guys get some sales out of this. You'll find that Coast to Coast listeners are avid readers, so I think you might see a bump in sales from your appearance here. I hope you do anyway. We'll go to our wild card line, Jason in Santa Rosa, California. Hi, Jason.
Hi, George. Hi, Frank and Andy.
Yeah.
My question is I know you're in the mafia, so you must have some behind-the-scenes access. Did you ever hear anything about any UFOs? And what did you think happened when 9/11 went down? And what does Timothy Geithner have to do with Chicago?
Timothy Geithner, isn't he with the president and something?
Yeah, Treasury.
Well, I'm sure if he's with the president, he's got something to do with Chicago, because the president's out of Chicago. As far as UFOs, I don't know about them. Maybe. Right,
UFOs, I can't help you. That I can't help you with. But
What was the other thing he said?
9/11.
9/11. Well, that was horrible. That was horrible, and you know, that was terrible. It was a disaster that should have never happened. I guess our country got a little lax. We're a spoiled country, but it tightened up our grip in our country. And it was just a sad day for America.
Well, let me ask you two guys it this way. You know, there were times when the government has come to the mob and asked for help. I mean, you know, help killing Fidel Castro. That plot began in Las Vegas. I think there was...
Right.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, World War II, they asked for help in protecting the docks. Ever been anything like that? Andrew, you first, where government people come to the mob and ask for some help with something?
It is a story. You know, this is a story that we heard, you know, one or two times in New York growing up. There was a guy with the Colombo crime family. His name was Greg Scarpa. Now, Greg Scarpa was a prolific guy. I mean, this guy was He was a really, really dangerous, dangerous man. And as the years passed, you know, they found out that he was cooperating with the government at some point. And when the story started to come out, it came out that he was supposedly, because of course I wasn't there, but he supposedly was called to help with finding those kids that were murdered, those civil rights kids in down south. And they were trying to find these kids for a decent amount of time, and they called on him, and he went there, and apparently he got the job done. They found the kids after he went down there, and I guess he went to work on somebody somehow, but he got the answers they were looking for, from what I understand.
In general, though, government is not a friend to guys in your line of work. Frank, I remember here in Las Vegas what it was like. I mean, they had wires everywhere. Even in your joint, they had high-tech bugs that you guys discovered, right?
Yeah. You know, we actually, you know, don't forget, George, the government's got taxpayers' money. They got millions and millions of dollars they could use that's at their disposal to come after a group of guys like us. We're not an army or battalion, you know, we're a group of guys. But we were always a step ahead of them as far as radio communication goes. And as soon as they found the way we were doing it, they'd use their resources for money and upgrade their equipment. And, you know, I mean, I found bugs in our, you know, when I say bugs, hearing devices, cameras and everything in our restaurants. And transponders underneath the cars where they could follow us where we're going. I used to locate that stuff all the time. But they kept on getting smarter and smarter. And like I said, it's all about money. You can't win when they got money and they got an army of guys that are working in here 24 hours a day. Government's hard. When the government goes after you, let me tell you something, you're going to jail. They should go after everybody in the Washington. That's what they should do, go against the house.
Well, Wall Street, too.
That's right. Clear up all that shit. We were just a group of guys. We never hurt small people.
Is it sort of a Robin Hood kind of an angle?
Well, I'd like to feel.
Not quite that.
I'd like to feel that way. But, you know,
Andrew,
we were out there to make a buck, you know what I mean? But, you know, I mean, we didn't cripple the people like what's going on now. It's ridiculous.
And in New York, Andrew, it seems like, I don't know, as careful as people like John Gotti were, no matter how careful you are, it always seems that they are able to catch somebody talking about this stuff on some kind of tap or camera.
Well, Chris, what happens is, like Frank said, you know, they're 24/7. And I'll tell you a story. I was incarcerated in federal prison down in Manhattan, in MCC. And I'll never forget, it was Christmas time, and me and this other guy was the captain in the Lucchese family, and we were cellmates. And we were talking about our friends and how they were out having a good time and this and that. It's Christmas time. And he looked at me, looked across the street, and the lights were on in the court building. And he said, "See that? Our friends are out drinking right now. But those guys across the street in that building, there's somebody in there signing their indictments. They're working over there." He said, "That's what our friends don't understand. Our friends go to sleep. These people never go to sleep."
Yeah, it's like rust. Andrew DiDonato, Frank Collada, Denny Griffin, our conversation will be continuing with these guys. We're going back to the phone lines with your questions for my guests. Again, I wanted to mention the books, Battle for Las Vegas by Denny Griffin, Surviving the Mob by Denny and Andrew DiDonato, and Collada by Frank Collada and Denny Griffin. Check them out if you get a chance. Right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Talking with crime writer Denny Griffin and two guys who are the real deal, Frank Collada and Andrew DiDonato, about their lives as mob guys, as wise guys. We come back for our final segment and your questions right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Don't know about you, but I am really enjoying this conversation with our guests. A lot of folks on the phones. In fact, the lines are full. We'll get to as many of your calls as we can. Kurt in Fairfield, California, been holding for a while. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, George. Listen, I had an open-ended question about what happened in Cleveland, Ohio, back in the 1970s. There was a book by Rick Portello called Kill the Irishman about how Danny Green single-handedly brought down the Italian mob in Cleveland. In fact, it got so bad they had to contract through New York, through the Gambino family, to finally have him whacked. So the two-part question is, do you know who specifically whacked Danny Green? And number two, Ralph Perk was aware of that. He was a very corrupt mayor of Cleveland. His successor was Dennis Kucinich. Dennis Kucinich fired all of Perk's appointees, and a guy named Anthony Lipitori, a maid guy, got pretty upset and supposedly told Tommy Sonito to kill Kucinich. Can you verify either one of those things? Thank you very much.
Maybe we'll start with Andrew on that one. Andrew, you know anything about somebody killing the – that's probably before your time, though.
Well, that's a little before my time, but I could tell you that from what I do know about it is that the investigator on the case, I remember, had said that somebody – there was a witness to somebody who was near the car when they blew up Danny Green. And from what I understand, they when they gave – the sketch artist came, the officer in charge on the case had knew the guy. So he seen the – as soon as he seen the sketch, he knew who they were talking about. He knew who was to look for. So I guess it was somebody who was local. So I don't believe it was from the Gambino family. But I could be wrong. But that's I think it was a local person who did it.
There's a heck of a movie about Danny Green, too. I Killed the Irishman. Frank, you know anything about it?
No, I don't. No, I don't know anything about Danny. I just, from what I seen on TV, that he was pretty ruthless, you know. But he was never going to win when it comes to the Italians. You know, they were going to get him.
The idea of putting a hit on a mayor, that'd be a pretty serious matter.
Well, absolutely.
Without a doubt. But, you know, there's been crazy things that happened. I mean, you know, in New York, they were conspiring to kill prosecutors. And then one of the prosecutors who they were conspiring to kill became a mayor. So it does happen.
Oh, Rudy Giuliani?
Yeah, Giuliani was marked for death at one time, for sure. There was a few guys. There was some judges, two that were marked for death. You know, they came up in cases where guys were indicted on conspiracy, or their names were come up on a piece of paper, and they held them in solitary confinement until they did the investigation to make sure. That's happened numerous times.
On the Skype line, Sean in Fontana, California. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi. Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Hi, Mr. Collado. Pleasure to meet you.
My pleasure.
It was a great movie. I had a question for you. Few things. How accurate were the portrayals of yourself, Anthony, and Ace, which was a casino manager, in the movie? Your relationship with Anthony, and what it was like, kind of being there with him in Vegas. What was the final thing that kind of brought down the Chicago mob in Vegas? And also, this is kind of a little funny, but the scene with the cowboy putting his feet on the table in the movie and getting kicked out, did that really happen?
No, I could. I'll start off with that. I can only remember so many questions.
Yeah.
Anyway, the scene in the movie, actually, there was a cowboy that did exist, and he used to play in the poker rooms for Tony. In other words, Tony would financially back him up to gamble for him in the poker rooms. And there was a cowboy, and that's the only reason why they injected a cowboy in the movie, because when I was telling Scorsese about it, they put this cowboy in there and they had to give him a little flair. So they did the scene where he put his kicked up his legs on the table, you know. And what was the other one?
The other questions basically deal with how accurate the movie was in characterizing the real life people.
Characterizing me was not really as much as I was in real life. In other words, they had to downplay me a lot and lift up Joe Pesci because he's the major star along with De Niro. So Frank Vincent's hands were basically tied when you got top-notch guys like De Niro and Pesci in there. So they portrayed me as good as they could have done, but it's not as accurate as it should have been. The movie... It's Hollywood, you know, there's a lot of fictitious stuff in there. They did a great job, but they could only go so far in that type of industry, you know, without crossing the line.
I think the broad strokes are pretty accurate, though, I mean, in telling the story of how things went down.
Oh, absolutely. Lefty was like that. I call him Lefty. His name is really Lefty Rosenthal. He's passed now. He's dead. But Lefty, they portrayed him very good because he was an arrogant guy, you know. And, of course, we knew Lefty in the 60s. See, Lefty's actually from Florida along with his father, so that's how we knew him, you know. But they portrayed him good. And half of that stuff is the way I told him Lefty was, you know. I explained to them how pompous he was and stuff like that, and the cars he drove, and I told him about their wives, how they reacted. So the movie was pretty much on the money, you know. He did a great job, Scorsese, on it. But, you know, it's Hollywood. You can only go so far. They got to glamorize it a little bit.
I interviewed Lefty a couple of times over the years, was at some of his hearings, and the last time I tried to talk to him before he died, I was going to fly to Florida and interview him. I said, I'd like to do a couple of news series, a whole week-long series on you. And he speaks in the third person. He goes, Frank Rosenthal is not interested in appearing on a news series. Frank Rosenthal would prefer to have a one-hour primetime special on the network. But you can recognize that's exactly how he talked.
Really, it was all about Lefty, you know.
Yeah, I know. East of the Rockies, Mike in Wisconsin. Hi, Mike.
Hey, George, how's it going, man?
Okay, what's on your mind?
Hey, I want to talk to Frank and Andy. I'm from Chicago. I live right down the street from Sam Giancani. I met Marilyn Monroe. This is 1960, 59. We lived on Winona, 1129 South Winona. And Sam's daughter she's the mafia princess. So I don't know what that other babe was talking about. Frank and Andrew, I found Sam's poodle ran away one day. I don't know if you guys were here that day, but I found Sam's poodle, and I brought it back to Sam. A bunch of guys sitting in the back by Sam's house around the pool, and he gave me $5. You know, it was a lot of money in 57, 59, or 60, you know. And then I got caught stealing an apple at the NP grocery store in Oak Park, and Marilyn Monroe come in there with some big guy, and I got busted stealing an apple, and she paid for my apple, and yeah, my you probably know my folks. Lyman Peterson, Coach Builder, built the limousines, President Kennedy's and Johnson's and all that. But you guys probably hung around with my dad. You probably knew my dad and some of his cohorts. But were you ever in the neighborhood when I found that poodle? Were you there that day? Or?
I'm sure I was around, but I don't know the incident.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I did a lot of work.
If it was this poodle, I'm sure he rewarded you over it.
Was there a reward, Mike?
Yeah, I got $5 for
$5.
$5
was a reward.
Just a bunch of guys sitting around the pool drinking their martinis or whatever. It was pretty cool. I was born and raised in Chicago.
Hey, well, we appreciate your insight into that. You're obviously a guy who's been around a long time. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Alan in Folsom, California. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I lived in Buffalo, and I was, you know, laying some bets, and I kind of got pretty much involved, and I thought, you know, I'm going to have to move. I was getting a little over my head, so I says, I'm moving west, and they said, well, if you go to Chicago, watch out for the police there. If you get caught and they got some kind of issue with you and they don't like you for some reason, they'll book you into jail and then conveniently lose all record of you.
That's happened.
You, like, just disappear. And I just want to confirm, did that happen quite a bit? Like, was it in the 70s?
Oh, yeah, it happened to me. That happened to me one day. They just kept on moving me from precinct to precinct, you know, and nobody knew where I was. Tony was trying for a whole day to try to figure out, and they keep on saying, well, he's not here. And then he'd have to call with another precinct, the bondsman. And they kept on trying, so finally, after they cut a deal with me, then they let it be known to where I was at. Yeah, they did that a lot.
Andrew, anything similar for you?
Well, they give you what they call, let's say, bus therapy. In other words, I've had some friends of mine and stuff like that. When they want to put the screws to you, they'll take you. A friend of mine got called to a Senate hearing in Washington, and he refused to speak. And what they did was, instead of flying him right back to the prison, like Frank said, they took him in the car and they moved him from precinct house to precinct house, from all the way from Washington, D.C., all the way back to New York. And it took him, instead of a one-day trip, it took him like 6-7 days. And he just went without a shower, without eating probably nothing, from precinct to precinct, as sort of like his penalty for not speaking.
I want to bring Denny Griffin back in for a second. Denny, before the program ends, you've written a couple of great mob books. Anything else in the works?
Yes, I'm doing two things now. I'm doing an entertainment book about, did you ever hear the Traineers used to be the big lounge act?
Sure, yeah,
Well, the saxophonist is 90 years old, Don Hill, and I'm writing his book. I hope to have it out this fall. And I just submitted another manuscript to the publisher for the story of the corruption in Stamford, Connecticut, back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, called Rogue Town. It's the true story of Vito Colucci, he was a cop, and he went undercover to wear a wire to help bring the crooks to justice. So I got the two things going.
You're a busy guy.
Yes, yes, I am. Thankfully.
First-time caller, John, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, John.
How's it going? Hey,
okay.
Guys, how's it going? Good, how are you?
What's on your mind?
Hey, a follow-up to what I believe it was Frank who said it, that there was a gentleman named Jasper who worked in a flower shop, and I almost wrecked my car when I heard you say that. But Jasper was tasked with the job of retrieving a package for me and my investors that we had put it into the computer group with Billy Walters in Georgia. You're in Las Vegas. You definitely know who Billy
sure.
Walters is and how often he's in the paper.
21.
But, you know, obviously we never got it. And whether, you know, he was part of Billy Walters' computer group or not, you know, the bookmaking operation that was so successful in the 80s and 90s. My question to you guys is how, before the internet and DirecTV and all the football channels and the 8 games on one screen, how intricate were your bookmaking operations when so much information was so limited? How successful were you guys?
You know, people, it depends what type of sport you're betting on. You know, like with the sports betting and stuff like that, where Frank Rosenthal, Lefty Rosenthal, he used to know when a basketball player had a sprained ankle or a cold, and he'd set the line, you know. So we had that advantage going there. As far as horse racing goes, you know, there was a time years ago that we would get the information before they would get it, the bookmakers. And we were able to beat bookmakers that way, but then they changed the wire system on that. So, you know, anybody that plays on horses for a horse to win has got to be a little loose in that anyway.
Andrew, any input on that and in terms sports
Frank,
betting?
Frank hit that on the head with horse races, because when we had the horse rooms and everything like that, sometimes we would give a rebate to the horse plays, because the horse plays you knew were going to get busted by the end of the week. So we would give them like a percentage back at the end of the week for the money they spent, because you knew at the end of the week. There's an old saying, George, all horse players die with broken shoes. And that's just the way it is. I mean, but, you know, when you think about it, with the internet today and then back in the day when we were, you know, taking bets, we were, you know, overall bringing in millions. And they're still bringing in millions today, but now they have easier access to, you know, all of these places off, you know, off the coast and stuff like that. And now they're making twice as much, but they still made millions back then from good old fashioned writing it on a pen and pencil. That's how we did it, you know.
Did the Gambinos ever fix horse races?
Horse races? Well, I knew a few guys that, you know, used to get tips or whatever like that, and they would say, listen, you got to put money on a horse like that. But I never had no inside information that it was actually coming from my crew, that there was that they were actually conducting that. That I'd never seen.
You know, you could have done it in the old days, but you can't do it no more. I'm familiar with it now. You know, these vets, they check the horse before they go out, and they check the horse when it comes back for drugs and whatever. In the old days, you know, you could get away with giving the horse a little something else to make them go a little quicker, you know, and that was done back in the old days, you know.
What about fixing it with the jockey?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, of course, you know, you would fix it with the jockeys. You could hold back on the horse, you know, let another horse go ahead. You know, you know what horse is good and what horse is bad. Of course, jockeys would go for it. They needed the money. Everybody, it's all about money.
I should point out that Billy Walters is a pretty well-known name here in Las Vegas, and he was mentioned in connection with the computer group years ago. He's still probably the most successful sports bettor in Las Vegas and in the world. We're going to go to Jeff in Palm Desert, try to get one more quick call in. Jeff, has to be a fast one.
Hey, guys, listen, I just grew up in Las Vegas and went to the only Catholic high school there, so I went with a lot of the kids. My dad was Spilotro's CPA when he was being indicted by by the courts, and I'd see him come into my dad's office with Oscar Goodman all the time. But, you know, growing up, when you'd see one of your friends' dads, like Al Bramlett, the head of the Culinary, or, you know, Three Stories of the Valley Bank blown away, and it was Ash Resnick to Lefty Rosenthal to, you know, quite a unique town growing up in. And I'm your old buddy, George, that used to have a beer with you at the Philly Pub every now and then. But
oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you send me emails from now and then.
Yeah, I sure do. But thank you for letting me put my two cents in. Nobody ever believes my story, so I quit telling them years ago.
Okay, thanks for that call. Frank, what's on your plate?
What's on my plate? There's something that's in the works with a reality show.
Really?
That Andrew and I are going to participate in. I can't tell you what it is right now, but it's in the works, you know, and hopefully it's accepted, and we'll be out there on TV making jokes, you know, making fools of ourselves.
Andrew, anything else you want to add to that?
No. Frank, you're on the head. I wish we could elaborate some more, but soon. Maybe you'll have us back soon, George, when we're able to speak more about it. But I'm very excited about it. Me and Frank are really good friends, and I'm looking forward to working.
And you've become friends because of the common interest in writing books and working with Denny?
Well, not only that, but, you know, me and Frank always say, you know, we were just, you know, different generations, but our lives really, really mirrored one another. I mean, down to, like, some real scary points, you know.
Let me interject a minute. You know what I told Andrew one day? I says, you know, when I was 26, you weren't born. I was doing the same scars you're doing when you were. You know, in other words, I'm... what is it, 50 years older than him or something, you know. And life is the same. It follows the same pattern just through generation after generation. Of course, nowadays it's a whole new ballgame with all this security system.
I guess it's a really small club that you guys are members of.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. You know, it's a very small community. I mean, the Chicago mob, all the New York families, you know, it's very small. After a while, everybody starts, you know, when you do business with guys, it's a small network. You know, it really is.
Andrew DiDonato, Frank Collada, Denny Griffin, I want to thank you so much for coming on and staying up so late with us. I hope people check out your books because it's very, very interesting stuff. Nathan and Gina and Lex, they're premier. Thanks for helping us with this program. I'll be off for my next scheduled appearance, but I'll be back for one show next month. Hope you'll tune in then. Good night, everyone.